Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to the World Soccer Talk podcast. My name is Christopher Harris and I'm joined by my co-host Kartik Krishnayar. Kartik, we've got a lot to get to in this episode. We, of course, will talk about the Premier League and I think we'll talk about some other leagues too because it was a big weekend for several specific players around Europe. Plus, we've got some news too about Peacock. Also, we'll be talking about Welcome to Wrexham, at least our initial thoughts in terms of the viewing numbers for that, for this new series on FX, as well as much, much more. So, Kartik, this past weekend, I actually watched more from around world soccer than I have done in the first 3 weeks of the Premier League season. And sometimes it's just circumstances where maybe I might be free in the afternoon or a late evening and switch on, you know, an MLS game watching Austin FC against LAFC or like today on Sunday recording this, PSG against Monaco. Barcelona against Valladolid, etc., etc. But of course, I watched several Premier League matches too. My most enjoyable match I watched all weekend was Nottingham Forest against Tottenham Hotspur. And I'm still in love with just the way that Nottingham Forest plays. And it's not the finished article by any means, but in terms of their style, and there were quite a few opportunities in this game too. I think whether it was Brennan Johnson or Nico Williams or Jesse Lingard or others on Nottingham Forest, balls coming across the box, but they just was missing that central striker to kind of get in there and knock it towards goal. And Spurs played very pragmatic, I thought, in terms of breaking on the counter and Harry Kane, of course, looking as good as ever. Son still looks kind of like he's not fitting into the system quite well. But overall, what about you? What were your thoughts about Forest and Spurs? And which match this past weekend was your most enjoyable to watch?
Well, I would agree on the Son comment. I mean, he is definitely not fitting into the Conte system this season, but he thrived in it last season. So I think it'll take a couple of games. And obviously, the other thing we're seeing is that Kulusevski is undroppable, right?
He looks so good.
Yeah, yeah. And I think the assumption was that either Lucas Moura would play there, or one of their new signings would play there, maybe you know you would even kind of flip Son to the right and play Perisic in that three man front line. There were all these kind of, or Richarlison, right? There were all these potential options that involved dropping Kulusevski that were talked about during the summer, which was kind of odd considering how good he was last season. I think he's undroppable. So yeah, that was an enjoyable match. I think certainly if you look at Saturday in the Premier League, well, I mean, to me, the most enjoyable match in England this weekend was Watford and QPR, but that was outside the top flight. I guess I would say the best match was probably there's a lot to choose from actually. Yep. That whole block of 3 p.m. kickoffs, with the exception of the Liverpool the Liverpool-Bournemouth match were good. I don't know which of those I would pick. Maybe Chelsea-Leicester because of the drama with Fofana, the red card to Gallagher, and Chelsea's ability, Chelsea introducing a new system also in that match and their ability to grind out a win.
Yeah, it was one of those weekends where in some windows of time, there were almost like too many matches to choose from, where there was so many great ones happening at the same time, where there was even Juventus against Roma was another one. I mean, Lazio against Inter on Friday at the same time as a championship match, so on and so forth. But overall, though, Kartik, I would say in terms of the Premier League, we're four games into the season, but who for you deserves to be the most under pressure right now as a manager among these British managers? And that's Brendan Rodgers at Leicester City, winless. Frank Lampard at Everton, winless. Scott Parker at Bournemouth, they've got one win. Or Steven Gerrard at Aston Villa with one win. Who for you stands out as the one that should be under the most pressure there?
Oh, it's got to be Gerrard. I mean, given the amount of money that has been spent by Aston Villa, and it's just the eye test, right? With Villa, they look completely disorganized, and I've said this all four matches they played. They beat Everton 2-1, but they were only good for about 30 minutes in that match, and were very fortunate they got 3 points in that match. And it came at a time when Everton could barely field a full 11, right? They were fortunate to play them when they played them. It's really bad, I think, in terms of Villa. They don't have good patterns of play. Out of possession, their shape looks ragged. And going forward, there's no continuity. And this is a side with a lot. Not only have they spent a lot of money, but I think they've spent a lot of money in similar positions. So they have repetitive players on the bench, which means maybe Gerrard's making the wrong squad selection decisions on match day, which puts you in a very, very, very tough position, because he certainly has solutions on his bench, right? Coutinho has been misfiring. He's got Buendia. He's got guys like Douglas Luiz on his bench. Ramsey has not had the sort of impact he did last season because he's not playing in the same sort of role as he was last season. He can't seem to decide what to do with Watkins and Ings. Leon Bailey had a great preseason, didn't play well in the first match against Bournemouth, has been kind of on the fringes since. So they've got all sorts of problems. I think their center back situation isn't very good either. Fullback situation, obviously Cash and Dina are two very, very good attacking fullbacks, but there seem to be some defensive weaknesses with both those guys this season. I'm not only worried for Gerrard, I'm worried for Villa, because there's no way they can continue to spend their way out of this. And maybe there's something wrong in that dressing room, because you have guys who come in on high wages, big transfer fees, that either aren't starting or were starting and had been bumped and aren't clear on their role. So I think he's first. Obviously, the focus has been on Brendan Rodgers because of the way Leicester has started. But I think I think we're getting to the point where we're going to stop making, or people like me who tend to make excuses for Rodgers. I seem to have developed this reputation, Chris, on Twitter of being like this big Rodgers fan. I had like multiple people tweet at me this week. Well, we know how you feel about him as a manager. We know you're really like a closeted Leicester fan. I do rate Rodgers highly, but I think we're getting close to that point with him. But maybe once they get Fofana out the door, then the problem is solved. I don't know what the dressing room is like right now because of that situation.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things that at Leicester, you've got, Schmeichel left, you got the Fofana turmoil, basically in the squad where, it's a lot of question marks, a lot of doubts, a lot about, in terms of transfers, if Fofana leaves, then, which is it's going to happen, if not happening already. Then you can bring players in. So Brendan Rodgers, I can give a little bit of a longer leash for him, because he is in a difficult situation right now. With Wesley Fofana was injured a lot last season. He's had other injuries too, and hopefully he'll bring some new players in. However, I do think that he may have overstayed his welcome at Leicester City, and you mean they have to start delivering results real soon. However, Steven Gerrard has got a wealth of riches in terms of players at his available to him. Yes, some injuries in there too, which always hurts. But I think with Aston Villa, it really is trying to figure out which team, which form, which style to play, which players to play in that system. And like you said too, with whether it's Leon Bailey or several of these other players not getting the amount of playing time that they actually deserve. So I think with Steven Gerrard, he does have to actually start doing things differently. He has to kind of mix things up a little bit and not be so rigid in terms of how he thinks it's going to work, because it's not working. Scott Parker, Kartik, I think, honestly, I mean, I know Bournemouth are in a tough situation. They look terrible. They look, I mean, absolutely awful. At this rate, you mean, they'll probably end up with the worst record in Premier League history. That's how bad they look. But they have played some really difficult matches against tough teams. And they did get that win in the opening day of the season against, or opening weekend of the season against Aston Villa. And from here on, it gets a little bit easier. I mean, the next three games are against Wolves, Nottingham Forest, and Brighton. So out of those three games, you would definitely hope to get at least maybe two wins. And then all of a sudden, they start to head in the right direction. However, I, the way this Bournemouth team is playing, I have zero confidence in Scott Parker in terms of defensively how poor this team is.
Yeah, he's... tried to impart a defensive philosophy into a team that he inherited that had all these kind of attacking instincts because they were managed previously by Eddie Howe and Jason Tindall. And I would say it really didn't work at the end of the last season in the championship. They got through, they got to second. Huddersfield did almost catch him. And Forest, Sheffield United, they all had closed really strong, right, and started poorly. But toward the end of the season, they were not. I wouldn't even say they were one of the top. Maybe they were one of the top six teams in the championship, but they certainly weren't in the top two. And that's just carried on into the Premier League this season. But when you look at those three upcoming fixtures, you said Wolves. I think Wolves at some point are going to get it going. Mm-hmm. And then you said Forest, we know how difficult that is. And then Brighton, I mean, I wouldn't want to play Brighton if I have defensive liabilities, because they'll pass you to death. I mean, maybe they'll only score once or twice, but they'll have 90% of the ball against a team like Bournemouth. So, it doesn't look good for them. But again, they my expectations are much lower for them than they are for Aston Villa. But Chris, I mean, credit to you. You said this, and again, I don't want to make judgments after four match days. I want to caution the listeners and say I'm a guy who doesn't even look at the table until after 10 match days. So I can't tell you what order these teams are in the table. But Aston Villa, you said in our preseason pod, you're very concerned about them. And I think, and I thought, okay, well, they have two. I said I was concerned about them also, but they had too many good players, right? They were too good to go down. That old adage. Well, I don't know. Based on what I see, they don't have any. You said something about Gerrard's system. I don't know that there is a system. I think that it's just chaos out there, to be perfectly honest with you.
Yeah, it seems that way. And it's still early, like you said, to Kartik. And even if Gerrard gets sacked at Aston Villa with the next, maybe during the international break, then a new manager comes in and they've got a good squad. They've got a really good squad. So somebody could come in and turn that team around. Leicester, same thing with them. Bournemouth, I think, is a lost cause, which is so sad, you mean, this early in the season. However, what about Everton, Kartik? There's, of course, a lot of transfer activity. Neil Maupay coming in, possibly Anthony Gordon going out, and probably some other activity too. But where does Everton stand in all of this?
Yeah, I think I'm fairly confident that if you get a Maupay in, you get maybe you can. There's still talk of Gaia coming back from PSG. There's a bit of a hang up there, but that might still happen. Maybe one other player in that midfield. I think it'll be fine. Now, that's contingent on not selling Anthony Gordon. So if they sell him, well, I don't think they can stay up without him, honestly.
All right, Kartik, we got into a disagreement about this one on Twitter, but if you were to sell Anthony Gordon, what do you think would be a fair transfer fee for him based on his value that you see in Anthony Gordon?
Well, his value is $100 million to Everton because they're going to get relegated without him. So we could start with that premise. Okay, that might not be fair in terms of his market value. But let's look at since it's Chelsea, the team that's chasing him. Chelsea has paid I don't have the amounts in front of me, but they paid an awful lot of money for Kai Havertz. They paid an awful lot of money for Romelu Lukaku. They paid an awful lot of money for Timo Werner. They paid a lot of money for Christian Pulisic. A little less money for Hakim Ziyech. They've turned down bids of they turned down a £35 million a pound bid once for Callum Hudson-Odoi, an even bigger bid that I'm forgetting for him at one point. So this is sort of the field they're in, right? These kind of big money attacking signings and attacking sales. Now, why do I think Gordon is worth more than most of the guys I just listed? Okay, so Havertz is a very one-dimensional player. Werner is a player that doesn't track back. Pulisic is a great direct one-on-one player, right? Great dribbler, fantastic finisher, right? Top 25 in the world, that stuff. The rest of his game is not very good, and I've said that for several years. I think now people are beginning to see agree with me on that. Gordon is more complete than those three guys I met. And Lukaku, I guess Lukaku's been good in some places, right, including Everton. But I just think Gordon, I'll tell you why I really rate Gordon. So he's a guy that can play all, let's say you're playing a 4-3-3. He can play each of those three positions across the front line. He can probably play as an attacking midfielder also, although obviously they have Mason Mount there. He is a guy in Tuchel's system. If Tuchel wants to go back to the wingbacks, he abandoned it this week for the first time in a while, but that seems to be his preferred thing, right? The three at the back. I think you can teach Gordon at this age to play a wingback position because he's much better at tracking back than Havertz, Werner, Pulisic. I mean, maybe we shouldn't talk about Werner anymore because he's not there, but they spent a lot of money on him is my point. I mean, I don't know what the number is, but I'm guessing that the number they spent on him is similar to what they're talking about with Gordon. He's better at tracking back. He's better at winning the ball back. He's a much more energetic counter-presser than Kai Havertz is, even though Havertz came from Germany, right? He came from a league where that's the MO. Pulisic's counter-pressing has gotten better, actually, in his couple of years at Chelsea. That's something I would say he's improved at. But I think Gordon, I mean, considering what they paid for those other guys, I put him at maybe the top of that list. Plus, he has had to take a team on his back, along with Richarlison, and save a team from relegation. He's had pressure in every single match. He isn't like some of these Chelsea guys that have, you know, they show up in a Champions League match, Havertz scores a spectacular goal, everyone thinks he's great, and then he mails it in for 5 weeks in the Premier League after that. It's this guy has shown consistency, he's shown grit, he's shown versatility. I think he's worth a lot of money. And if I'm Everton, I don't sell him.
We shall have to wait and see what happens to Anthony Gordon, because what I see when I see him play is a very energetic player, very aggressive in a good way, goes down way too easy in the box, and I just don't see much from him in terms of an attacking presence, scoring lots of goals. So maybe it's one of those things that I'm missing. You're seeing obviously different things than I am, Kartik, in your analysis. However, to me, he reminds me a little bit of Dele Alli, where younger, he showed a lot of promise and a lot of kind of passion, creativity, and then eventually fizzled out. And moves to Besiktas in Turkey. I could be completely wrong on this one, Kartik. You might be completely right. But I think this will be an interesting one to watch no matter where he goes. If he does stay at Everton, or if he does go to Chelsea, or if some club comes in at the 11th hour and signs him to, I don't know, Newcastle United or something like that. But out of Brendan Rodgers, Frank Lampard, and Scott Parker, and Steven Gerrard, who do you think would be most likely to be given the sack first on those four?
I assume it's probably Parker, because although there was a there was an investment from Bournemouth to lure him away from Fulham, although I think Fulham pretty plainly wanted to go in a different direction. There was constant tension between Tony Khan and Scott Parker when Scott Parker was managing Fulham. Not that there hasn't been tension between Marco Silva and Tony Khan. I just think that that's a byproduct of that ownership. But yeah, I think he'd probably be the easiest to sack. I have a feeling Lampard will be around for a while because Lampard seems to have even usurped Mashiri now in transfer in influence. It's just a dysfunctional situation at Everton. Lampard has assumed more power than previous Everton managers just by default. Or maybe he's the one usurping the power. Maybe it's not that there's a void. He's actively trying to prevent. Because let's remember, when we talk about Lampard, Chris, real quickly, at Chelsea he had Marina Granovskaya and Petr Cech calling the shots, not buying the players he wanted specifically, and then buying him players he did not want. So I think at Everton he's been very aggressive about preventing that from happening again to him at a second club. And then Rodgers, you would think Rodgers has a lot of credit in the bank, right? I mean, based on the current circumstance, Rodgers would actually be the first to go, given where Leicester has been, given the fact that they look completely out of sorts, and we know the kind of summer they had. But would you agree with me, Chris? He has too much credit in the bank. He's won an FA Cup. Mm-hmm. He's come really close to qualifying for the Champions League multiple times. So they've been in Europe several times under him. I just don't think you can turn around and sack him that quickly.
Yeah, I think for all four clubs, it comes down to the ownership in terms of how plugged in the ownership is and how willing they are to go ahead and pull the plug. And with Leicester, I don't get that. I don't have as much of an intimate knowledge in terms of the investment group there now. So laser focused in terms of aspirations. I think that's a lot of it too, is aspirations. I mean, whether it was Watford in the past, the Italian family that was running the club there. I mean, in terms of, you mean what their aspirations are, where they think, okay, the club should be in the top six, top seven, whatever it may be, and if they're in 12th, you mean that to them is a failure. In reality, you mean that's a great position to be in. So Leicester, Everton, I think I'm with you there in terms of Everton and Frank Lampard probably having a longer leash. The club's still in a lot of turmoil. There's still a lot of question marks about maybe a new investment coming in. So if there is a new owner, then things may change. But Frank Lampard still has a good rapport with the Everton fan base. The Everton fan base has not turned yet. The results have been, to me, underwhelming. But there hasn't been a lot of defeats. There's been, you mean, some draws, but still winless. Bournemouth is a question mark, and you probably know more in terms of that, and you've already mentioned that. And Aston Villa, too. Aston Villa have high aspirations. They've spent a lot of money. They should be in the top 10. They should be, you mean, top 6, top 7, maybe, perhaps, on the fringes there. However, flip that table upside down, and that's where they're at. So I think at the end of the day, I think it really comes down to ownership and how aggressive they are in terms of wanting success and the reality of where they are at right now with the current managers.
Yeah, and with Everton so close to opening their new stadium, I don't think they want to go through a season of increased turmoil. So they're going to keep faith with Lampard, I think, longer. I think he's probably in the best position of the four you mentioned, which isn't a great position. It's just relative to the other three. Although, again, in my opinion, if they sell Gordon and they don't buy an adequate replacement, which I don't think they can buy an adequate replacement unless they reinvest the $60 million or whatever they get for him immediately, I don't know. I think they'll go down then.
Yeah, Everton's got a little bit more leash, a longer leash than that too, because the new stadium, Bramley Moor Dock, is going to be ready for the 2024-25 season. So Everton's got this season to try to stay up, and then they've got next season to try to, stay up or wherever they are, but basically kind of get back into the Premier League or stay within the Premier League before the 2024 season kicks off. And that's the key point. The last thing they want to be is in a championship in that season. So they've got a little bit of opportunity there. This will be really interesting to watch in terms of the next few weeks, if there are any pressures. And again, too, we've got midweek matches coming up. We've got a lot of midweek matches, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. It's a full game week of fixtures. And then before you know it, it's the weekend again, next weekend. So these games will come thick and fast. Kartik, what about, we haven't mentioned Liverpool, Manchester United, Arsenal, or Manchester City yet. From those four heavyweights, and anything in particular that you think there was enlightening this weekend?
Yeah, Man United ability to grind out a win when they didn't play particularly well away from home has got to be encouraging. Obviously, Liverpool, big bounce back victory, and very, very very, very effective in flipping the script on the narrative with them. Manchester City, I think they have a real problem shipping goals early in matches now, and this is an increasing problem where they're playing from behind a lot. I think that you're seeing their lack of center back depth. They're down to two fit center backs, really impacting them. We're seeing some uncharacteristic errors also from players at Manchester City. So some warning signs there. And then Arsenal, I guess they grinded out that win against a good Fulham team, a Fulham team that's playing very well. I think for Arsenal, it's good they're not dropping points in these sorts of matches, but there are bigger tests that await. But so far, so good.
All right, what about Brighton against Leeds United? Definitely an interesting match for a lot of Americans tuning in to watch this one. Not the 3 points that a lot of Americans were hoping for Leeds United against a Brighton side. You mean a couple of seasons ago, if you said that Brighton against Leeds would be one of the top matches on a Saturday, probably somebody would look at you with a strange look. But It was it. But what for you could you take away from this match?
Yeah, I just think Brighton are really good. I mean, they're very, very good in controlling the tempo of matches. They're very good in forcing other sides, particularly counter-pressing sides, to drop deeper and then to play around them, right? So I think you saw a lot of Leeds trying to play around the Brighton midfield when they got possession. So Brighton, very, very good. This Graham Potter side has been a favorite of ours for several seasons now. Maybe they haven't been getting the results that their play justified until the start of this season, or their points in last season that they were getting good results. There is still an issue with Brighton not scoring the number of goals they should. I'm not a huge fan of the XG statistic. I don't look at it very often, but I do notice that Brighton typically falls below their XG, right?
Yep.
Match after match. So that's something that I would be pretty concerned about. You know, on the Manchester City issue, I realize that this is the same way Bayern Munich started last season. And it eventually led to Bayern being bumped out of the Champions League earlier than we expected. So Bayern were winning games in Germany. They won the league as usual, but they were winning a lot of 4-2 matches. They were typically giving up the first goal in a match and chasing a game down. And I see a lot of that in Manchester City. So I think certainly for me, they're not title favorites based on what I've seen. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say about the Brighton Leeds United match. To me, watching this game, it was, yeah, you're right. They're missing kind of a really prolific number nine. And the feeling I got from watching this match is that Brighton could have won this one 3-0, 4-0, something in that regard. The amount of possession, the amount of chances they had, and the amount of shots they were trying to take. And fair play to Leeds in some way, because they definitely got a lot of men behind the ball and were blocking a lot of shots. But the domination by Brighton in this match was pretty excessive. And this Brighton obviously is a good team. We talked about four British managers at the bottom or near the bottom of the Premier League under pressure right now. And then you look at Steve Cooper with Nottingham Forest, roughly mid-table or just below mid-table. And of course, Graham Potter, with Brighton and British managers again, but however, having a much greater success rate. But what about this Leeds team, Kartik? I mean, I've raised the point in previous episodes that my concern about this team is defensively, is that what did you see in this match from Leeds specifically?
Yeah, I think defensively they do have some weaknesses, and maybe, again, credit that they only gave up a goal, but that seems to be the way it goes with Brighton. So I'm going to read the last 12 seasons, Premier League clubs that have started on 7 points in their first three matches and have been relegated. So Blackpool under Ian Holloway, that was heartbreaking when they went down, right, because they played such good football. They had 7 points through their first three matches in the 2010-2011 season. They finished 19th. The 2011-2012 season, the Wolves under Mick McCarthy started with 7 points after three matches, and they were relegated on 25 points in 20th, and McCarthy didn't make it through the season. Hull City, 16-17 under Mike Phelan, 7 points through nine matches, relegated on 34 points in 18th. That was after Marco Silva came in and got them into a position where they were 18th, right? When Phelan left, they were going to finish 20th, I think, or 19th or 20th, right? They were in real bad shape. And then the West Brom team the next season under Alan Pardew started with 7 points. They were relegated in last in the table on 31 points. So, I like what we've seen from Leeds thus far this season until this match, but the folks who've said that you and I were absolutely wrong, we made the wrong prediction, we need to back off of it. This is why you don't make judgments, particularly about teams near, that are predicted to be near the bottom of the table after three matches. There is a history of teams going down. In fact, at one point, I'm trying to remember when this was. But there were a couple successive seasons where there were teams, Chris, that won on the opening day match of the season 4-0 on the opening day and then went down. I think it was three successive years that happened. So the Premier League is a grind. It's a really difficult competition. And you can't make snap judgments after a couple matches or based on one or two matches or highlight clips or whatever. And this season, because of the World Cup, is going to be more of a grind. I'm not saying Leeds are going to go down. They certainly have been better than I thought they would be. But I do think they're still very much in a relegation dogfight. And until they're able to get to 40 points, or let's say 38 points, we're going to continue to think that they're in that potential danger.
Yeah, definitely. And looking at their fixtures coming up too, I mean, that's the key point, right? Is that not getting our hopes up too early, being more realistic than some soccer fans are kind of just going thinking, okay, what they're calling MLS, like I don't know, Major League Leeds Soccer or something like that. They're just going way getting excited about this. But some of the fixtures they have coming up, they play Everton, Brentford, Nottingham Forest, Manchester United, and then Aston Villa. So, you know, that midweek game against Everton, which is going to be in USA Network, that'll be a good test to see where they're at. Next weekend against Brentford, very difficult match. Nottingham Forest, a difficult match. And then you got the Manchester United and Aston Villa. So there's some winnable games in there. A few weeks from now, I think we'll have a much better indication of what this Leeds is made. This team is made of. There's a long, long way to go, though. Kartik, anything else from the Premier League from this past weekend that we haven't covered that you want to mention?
Yeah. On the flip side, there's been a lot of hot takes about West Ham, because they did start the season terribly, and they're in Europe, right? So part of it is that they're in the Europa League or Europa Conference League, so they've had some midweek matches. But David Moyes, and again, this is going further back, and maybe if there's one thing that people can really criticize me for and are right in some cases, it's that I rely on history too much for some of my analysis. I just did it with Leeds, right? But David Moyes' teams at Everton, I haven't actually looked this up, the specifics, but I remember, and you probably remember this, Chris, too, many, many seasons they would start really slowly and they'd be in the drop zone and the transfer deadline would be coming and we'd say, oh, Everton have to sign a bunch of players. You know, they've run their race with Arteta and Osman and Cahill and Fellaini. They need new players. And then you look at the table and you look at the table in March and they're in sixth, right? Even though they were in 20th in October. So Moyes has a history of doing this. I think West Ham are going to be fine. They could be getting Paqueta.
Yeah.
Which is, I can't believe he's not going to Bayern or to PSG or to Liverpool, right? I don't know why that is. I don't know if there's something specifically, maybe that he was at Milan when he was really young. It didn't go well for him. But if you've seen him for Brazil, saw him in the Copa America, saw him for Lyon, I think that that's just, I don't know how long it'll take Moyes to bet him in. But boy, if they get that deal over the line, I know they started poorly. I still think West Ham have a good chance to be in that top six at the end of the season if they get that guy. It's going to come together.
Yeah, and I think part of it too is the attraction of West Ham United being in London. You mean for a Brazilian that's looking at handsome personal terms in terms of how much money he'll be making. But then also living in London, living in the cosmopolitan city, as opposed to go into, say, Newcastle or someplace else.
Look, I don't want to get too deep into it on today's pod. Maybe we'll do a whole specific pod on this at some point, Chris. But I think, and this is also plays into Brighton's success in getting, in not just having Graham Potter, but some really silky, smooth footballers. I think there is an attraction to London now that makes clubs like West Ham and Palace and Fulham and Brentford and potentially Queen's Park Rangers, if they can get back into this division, QPR, more attractive than they were historically. And then I would add Brighton to that just because of the sort of town Brighton is. So as we're bringing more international players into this league, as it's becoming more and more cosmopolitan, there's a preference to live in certain places. And this is making the London clubs look. There was a period of time, the first 10 years of Premier League history, where Spurs were fighting relegation more often than they were fighting to be in Europe, right? And then now we just automatically think of them as a top six club. I think that has had a lot to do with geography.
Yeah, absolutely. In terms of being able to sign some of these top players and convince them to play in London versus maybe Manchester or Liverpool. Of course, they get some big players too, but London does have an influence. Now, Kartik, before we move on to the next segment, I'm sure you caught Josh Sargent again scoring for Norwich. He's really on form right now, scoring against Sunderland, beating the Black Cats there. But any other Americans that stood out for you from Europe this past weekend?
Yeah, I think Tim Ream really stood out for me. He has been every week this season. I don't know what the case is not to take Tim Ream to the World Cup. Even if he doesn't play, you need a leader like that in the dressing room. But I'm sure a lot of people will push back on that. I don't know why. So I think Timmy Ream was great. I think Pifok or Sibachu, whichever you prefer, was, again, he didn't score this week for Union, by the way. He's been scoring. He's already scored three goals between league and cup competition this season in the Bundesliga, or between the Bundesliga and the German Cup. He was in the middle of a lot of the attacking moves in their 6-1 win over Schalke. I watched that match in its entirety and was really impressed by his movement, really impressed by his passing, and also how effective a counter-presser he is, which I guess, look, I have to admit, there are blind spots in my knowledge. I don't watch the Swiss League. I'll readily admit that. So he's been a passing curiosity to me because he plays for the U.S., but I'm seeing a lot of this player the last couple of weeks since he moved to Union, and I'm loving him. I think he's phenomenal. Josh Sargent is one of my favorites. It's, I think most people know, favorite U.S. players. So I those are my two guys I'm taking to the World Cup as a number nine. I know I hear a lot of people talking about Ferreira and Pepe, and Pepe got the start for Augsburg, by the way, this week, which is a good sign. They're talking about other guys. I mean, you probably. Can rattle them off, Chris. I know I'm forgetting some guys, but Haji Wright, who I'm partial to because he played in the NASL, but I just Sargent is always on the plane for me. I don't care how poorly people thought he played last season for Norwich, because he didn't, and he can play across the front forward line all three positions. Some of the analysis I gave of Anthony Gordon, by the way, Chris, applies to Josh Sargent. Now, he's not as high level, but some of that analysis does apply to Josh Sargent in terms of versatility, tracking back, counter-pressing. So to me, he has to be on Berhalter's 26. And then now I'm favoring PFOC over Wright and Ferreira and Pepe. Again, it's been four matches, four Bundesliga matches and one cup match. So it's been five matches. Could fade, but I haven't seen very much of this player before. I'm really impressed with him.
Yeah, for me, it's one of those things that we're looking at, September 23rd. I think there's a friendly against Japan. And this is the opportunity to really give these players some chances to be in the squad, see what they're made of, and see how they compete against a high-level team. Because, I mean, the Bundesliga is great, the Championship is great, but let's see how they play in terms of international football. And can they continue that form? Because, I mean, that's where it matters the most. And also playing with, I mean, different teammates that may not... have that knowledge in terms of the types of balls you like to receive, whether it's, a lot of it's chemistry, I think, sometimes too, so it will take time. But at least there's some optimism there too in terms of the striking front for the US men's national team. Before we head into the TV streaming news, Kartik, what about games to watch this coming weekend? Mine would be the Milan Derby, Inter Milan against AC Milan on Saturday, noon Eastern time on Paramount Plus. What about you?
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Yeah, because you chose that would have been my choice. But by the way, loving Napoli so far in Serie A. A little shout out there to Spalletti and the boys. I think that they've had a good enough squad under previous managers to really compete. Well, obviously they competed under Sarri, but under Ancelotti and Gattuso, I think they underachieved. And they've kind of retooled the squad this year, right? A lot of transfer activity, and they look really good. So that's a good shout. Because you would pick that, I'm going to go Leeds-Everton, 3 p.m. on Tuesday on USA Network, which I think is a critical game for Everton. And by that time, we might know if they are keeping Gordon or if he's gone. And for Leeds, an important bounce back match. So I think that's a key game. And I should point out, as much as we've talking about Everton struggling, the two matches they lost by one goal. So they haven't been tonked yet the way they haven't looked quite like Aston Villa or Bournemouth, right? I mean, or Leicester. Leicester has looked. We didn't get into the Leicester-Chelsea match, but Leicester up a man for, 60 minutes or more? They just performed so poorly. So that's my recommendation. Leeds-Everton's on USA.
And Kartik, I think that's a British expression, tonked, which is thrashed, right? There you go. Just for our American listeners who are wondering what Kartik is talking about there. In terms of TV streaming news, let me lead off with that. You mentioned transfer deadline day, and you mean some of these moves might be happening during the matches Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday of the Premier League. But Sky Sports transfer deadline day special is going to be on Thursday. It's going to be live on Peacock, starting at 3 p.m. Eastern time and going all the way through. And also, I think NBC Sports is planning on having Goal Zone for a one-hour special, I think, from 5 p.m. to 6 p.m. So, but the if there is going to be a crazy day, which there might be some big moves made that day, Peacock is the place to go. Speaking of Peacock, we interviewed a couple of the executives from Peacock last week. We have the articles on worldsoccertalk.com, which go into more detail. But they do have a new feature on Peacock, if you've seen it. It's called Key Plays. And for me personally, I got to experience it this weekend, watching on Sunday a change from the Aston Villa West Ham game. I thought, okay, let me go check out the Wolves game against Newcastle. And went to Peacock, went to it. It was probably about 10 minutes into the game or so. And it said, okay, before we go ahead and actually show you the game live, if you want to watch it live, you can. Or if you want to, you can go ahead and see the key plays that you missed. And I went to the key plays, and it showed me all the activity for the first 10 minutes of the match, whatever it was. And I could actually see what happened. And after watching that, then you can click on another button to go live to the game itself. Or you can go ahead and actually, I think you can start the game over from the beginning if you wanted to. Really cool feature, really well done, and that's on Peacock. One more thing about Peacock, too. The rumors are, reports are in Variety that Peacock is going to have a special price in September, 1 month only, and it's going to be, instead of the $4.99 for a month for Peacock Premium, it's going to be $1.99. For that month. Or if you want to go ahead and get the annual plan, we'll have more details at worldsoccertalk.com, but it sounds like there's going to be some major savings there if you want to go ahead and get Peacock for the entire 12 months and save a huge amount of money. Kartik, what about you? So I'll hand it over to you for some news.
Yeah, welcome to Wrexham, debuted this week on FX and on Hulu. Obviously, I think everybody knows the story, Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhenney by Wrexham. And the overnight ratings were not great for episode one and episode two. They're not terrible, but 319,000 for episode one, 225K for episode two on FX. We don't know how many people watched on Hulu, and people like me might be guilty of why this rating is very misleading. This number is very misleading. I did set my DVR to tape both episodes on FX. I also ended up going to Hulu before I went to my DVR the next day and watched both episodes on Hulu. And did not watch it within the 24 hours. You would have to watch it on your DVR to count in that rating. So I think it's pretty misleading. And if you guys missed the first two episodes, I think my critique, Chris, would be it's not yet Sunderland Till I Die, but it certainly is better than the Juventus documentary and the Man City one and the Bayern one on Amazon, right? All these kind of high-end club documentaries. There did seem to be something very rehearsed about the way they bought the club, right, and the way that was filmed. But I think the final match of the 2020-2021 season...
No spoilers.
Okay. I'll just say this, which was in the second episode, they caught a raw side of that you don't see in propaganda-ish club films. So yeah. That's more Sunderland Till I Die. So first episode I'm watching, this seems very much like all or nothing Arsenal. And then the second episode I'm like, okay, this is good. This is taking off. So no spoilers. I don't want to say what happened specifically, but that's my read. So stick with it after one episode if you're turned off, is my point.
Yeah, see, for me, and I'm biased on this one too, Kartik, and we may end up doing like a whole episode just on this one, on this series, talking about it in more detail. But to me, this is so good. This is so, I mean, it's really enthralling. And to me, it pulls me in terms of the story, getting to know the players and the families and what it means to the community. And that aspect I like a lot. It's a lot about the people in Wrexham. So whether it's the pub owner, or if it's the supporters group, or if it's the actual players and their family, to me that's the hook. That's the story there, and the rest of it's really good. It does feel very much in terms of the buyout. Maybe the buyout was that easy, and it happened so smoothly that it was okay. We do maybe. This. Yeah, but go ahead.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say if you're watching, don't please listen to Chris and don't turn it off after the first episode, because maybe the buyout was that simple. I thought it looked very rehearsed, and I was thinking, this is the same thing as we complain about. And then episode two, wow, yeah, I'm with you. That was amazing. Yeah,
I think first episode I think it's great. Second episode's wonderful. I'm really looking forward to episode three. But I think in many ways, though, too, with this one, just like you, Kartik, I didn't watch it live. I think I watched it on Friday, and it took me about an hour to get through the first episode because I kept on pausing it and saying to my wife and daughter, I'm like, hey, that's that bridge. We've been on that bridge. We've crossed it with the canal boats, or pause it when they go into the city center and go, hey, that pub or that church, we've been there. We've driven past that, and those types of things. So actually, for me, it's yes, I'm biased. I have family that live in Wrexham and in the area and are supporters of Wrexham. But so far, it's really good. And I think it has definitely a human aspect to it in terms of just a really great story in terms of where it's heading. And so far, I'm really excited. But yeah, we will get to Welcome to Wrexham in more detail in future episodes, I'm sure. All right, let's move on to the listener mailbag. And first up is Zach. Zach with a really good observation here about the Premier League. He says, during the Southampton against Manchester United match, the announcers mentioned how surprised they were that more substitutes had not been made to that point due to it being a warm day on the south coast. I know this summer has been a scorcher at times throughout Europe, so I asked Siri what the temperature was. To say I was surprised was an understatement when she told me 73 degrees Fahrenheit. Am I missing something? Are Premier League footballers just that fragile, or do temperatures hit different when they're in centigrade? And Kartik, I think obviously it's a lot, normally it's a lot colder in the UK. They're not used to higher temperatures like we have in the United States. I mean, depending on where you live in the US, I mean, the temperatures differ widely, but we're obviously in Florida where we're used to 73 for us is, I mean, some people would consider
that's winter.
a cold day. But what's your take on this? Were you surprised by this?
Yeah, I think the first few match weeks we've had some temperatures above 30 Celsius and actually that's above 90 Fahrenheit, and particularly the first weekend of the season, the matches in London were very warm and affected, I think, the tempo of matches, etc. Yeah, I think maybe the sun was out, because remember that was a 12:30 kickoff British time, so maybe the sun being out and no obstruction on the sun like you normally have in Britain with clouds and potential rain made the 73 feel a lot warmer. That's very possible, because if you're directly in the sun, I can tell you this because I think a lot of you who follow me on Twitter know I go hiking and go to state parks and national parks. To me, there isn't, and maybe this is just me, there isn't a whole lot of difference than being out in the hot sun, in the direct sun, at high noon in the mid 70s and a hot summer day that's in maybe the upper 80s. Now, if it gets above that, yeah, you can tell the difference. But I think it probably was a byproduct of the start time. And we've seen also, Chris, it's another South Coast club, Bournemouth. Their matches that have started at that start time, you see the sun baking the pitch, right? I don't think St. Mary's is quite designed the same way as the Vitality, but we've seen that at Bournemouth for a number of years.
Yeah. Watching Bournemouth matches at home, oftentimes like the sun, the glare from the sun makes it really difficult to watch those games. Where the camera positions are, it's not the ideal stadium to watch a game from on television. Now in person, I'm sure it's different. Major League Soccer, Chris has some comments here. He says, a few days ago, I was talking with my friends about the playoff structure in MLS and how the season should end. And one of them mentioned that MLS should eliminate the playoffs entirely and do a table format, but keep the February through October calendar to avoid competing head-to-head with other sports such as the NFL by cutting the number of games per season so that clubs, regardless of conference, play each other only once. He also said that the U.S. Open Cup should only be for lower division soccer, USL and below, and amateur clubs only. My question to either of you is, do you see such a format working out for Major League Soccer and the American soccer pyramid as a whole? Kartik, I can guess your answer before you give it, but feel free.
Yeah, so I think that it would be very, very good to change the MLS schedule that way, the calendar that way. But I would say that they will never do it, and they're wed to the playoffs. They're wed to this spring calendar. And so even in your proposal, Chris, if you actually not fall to spring to fall, if you keep the spring to fall, as you said, February to October, you still gain a benefit for relevancy for matches if you don't have playoffs during the regular season. So I think flipping the calendar is essential, but I still think that your proposal has merit. In terms of the U.S. Open Cup, that's been debated, right? I mean, I think I liked it better when some MLS teams had to qualify to get in. They had their own qualifying rounds, and not all the MLS teams were placed right into the U.S. Open Cup. I think maybe that's the solution. You have 16 spots for MLS clubs, and maybe the top 8 teams from the previous season, they go right in, and then everybody else plays off for the final 8. That's the way I would solve that.
Yeah, for me, I think it's in terms of Major League Soccer, I don't see anything changing, and anything at all. It's going to be status quo, and unless FIFA stepped in or U.S. Soccer stepped in to say, okay, we're going to have to change things here in terms of the way your league is structured or the calendar or all these different things that could change, they're not going to change. And it's, I think this is a league that's very stubborn, that's very set in its ways, and doesn't like to change, really. I mean, this league hasn't changed much when you think about it. It's just expanded, and it's going to keep on expanding. Now, next up is we'll skip this one for now. We'll come to it in a little bit. But we do have a listener voicemail who the listener has a great question. But let me leave that for a little bit. Let me move on right now to the European Super League. This is a topic that came up a couple of times in the last episodes. And this comes from Dave. The comment that the Premier League is becoming a de facto Super League is intriguing. My gut sense is that the Super League was driven by desperation. Some founders need to secure seats at the table before their cachet declines, while some laggards joined reluctantly out of the fear of missing out. As time goes on, founders may even get even more desperate. Barcelona, for example, seem to be eating their seed corn. But fear of missing out for laggards may fade. 5 years from now, will Manchester City or Arsenal or Liverpool have any concerns if Real Madrid and Juventus have a party without them? I think it's a good point, a good question by Dave, and some very good points. I think it depends on the money. You mean, so yes, clubs such as Manchester City, Arsenal, Liverpool, etc. are making so much money from TV revenue. But if Real Madrid and Juventus did have a European Super League, what's the opportunity? What's the actual prize money? What's the amount of money that would be guaranteed from a TV revenue perspective? What does that offer? However, I could see conceivably that the Real Madrid's, Juventus's, Bayern Munich's, not the Bayern Munich's, Barcelona's, PSG, maybe some others could figure out a way to do some type of European Super League and not have the Premier League teams involved in that. What do you think, Kartik? Any thoughts on this one?
Yeah, I don't think they'll be able to do it without English teams. I just don't think they'll have the global popularity to do that. So I think the Premier League's in the catbird seat. I think they're effectively the de facto Super League. That's going to increase with the next set of TV deals and that built-in advantage. This stuff is very cyclical, right? Through the years, you know, you look at a situation where Serie A was the dominant league, I think, in the transfer market in terms of spending, maybe even visibility in the 90s, early 2000s also. La Liga had an ascendancy. We've seen periods where the Bundesliga has been near the top. But I think now the cycle is kind of broken and England is going to race away. So I don't know. I think maybe Florentino Perez, it was so poorly botched and so poorly executed, so badly botched and so poorly executed, the Super League attempt, that you think, yeah, he didn't put much time or thought into it. But maybe in reality, the timing was right, because he knew that if it didn't happen then, the clubs on the continent were going to be at an even bigger disadvantage and even less marketable the next time it was tried.
That's actually good timing now for the listener mailbag, for the voicemail we've gotten from one of our listeners in regards to what we just discussed. Unfortunately, he didn't leave a name, but I do recognize the voice from one of the callers into the Football Miami TV YouTube show. So, Kartik, let me go ahead and play that audio right now.
Hey, guys. I've been a long-time listener now, but I haven't really reached out to the podcast in any way, shape, or form. So I thought I'd send a voice message with a question. But I know that the MLS has recently done that Apple deal that you guys have spoken about in the podcast. And so I'm from Miami, Florida, and you know, it's a big city. There's this huge appetite for soccer. And it definitely bleeds from this cultural mix that we have here. I myself, I'm Hispanic, and it's just so natural to really fall in love with the sport. But my question is the following, though. I know in years past, Miami FC is lower division team that we have here. It kind of gained this cult following. And then you know, there was rumblings of Inter Miami being a thing, and then it officially became an MLS team, and I feel like that's kind of swallowed up the popularity that Miami FC had here in the area. And I think that was, I think Miami FC had this popularity here because there wasn't really any soccer here in this area. But to get to my question, though, it just feels like Inter Miami has been kind of disappointing the past few years, and the MLS appetite has kind of been waning here, and to the point where it's just normal for me to see much more ETL fans. Of course, there's tons of Madrid and Barcelona fans here, and it just feels like MLS was or Inter Miami was the flavor of the month, and it's just gone now. So I'm just curious to see if you guys think this MLS Apple deal would kind of generate more enthusiasm in just culture in America again for the local teams, because just at least here in Miami, Inter Miami, I don't know, it just feels like it's not really effective culturally here. You know, we have, I mean, I'm a huge EPO fan as well, and I guess it doesn't help that the season has been exciting so far. But it just feels like more teams are just more tuned across the pond with all the other major leagues, and MLS is just like it has its moments where it's there, but it just wanes. And I'm just wondering if this gap is only going to get bigger and bigger, or if there's a possibility where it would shrink.
So Kartik, his question to us is, what about the Apple MLS deal starting next year? Do you think the gap between Major League Soccer and the Premier League is going to get bigger and bigger, or could it shrink?
I think it's going to get bigger and bigger, and that's not a reflection of MLS. That's a reflection of the Premier League racing away. I do think the gap between MLS and the other leagues on the continent could begin to shrink. So what will the gap between MLS and Serie A in 2032? Well, that deal will run through 2032, right? Yeah. In 2032 look like it does now? No, I think that gap will probably shrink in that period because of this Apple deal. Now, will it shrink to where MLS is competitive with Serie A? Probably not, but the gap will close slightly. Will the gap close with the Premier League? No, but no one is closing any gap with the Premier League is basically my longer narrative about all of this.
Yeah, it is interesting because it is one of those things that I think, I'm right with you on that one, Kartik, where I think the Apple MLS deal is a good deal. It's good for Major League Soccer. However, there is the risk of them being out of the equation where, soccer fans tune into, watching matches over a weekend and have ESPN Plus or have Paramount Plus or have Peacock. All three of those are available each for less than $10 a month. So you've got, basically for $20 a month, you've got access to over 5,000 games from around the world every season. And with Apple and the MLS TV deal, we don't know what that price is going to be yet. It could be $100 a season. It could be, $30 a month. It could be, we don't know that yet. So there is going to be something where, and also for Android users, yes, there's a way for Android users to watch MLS on the Apple TV app, the MLS TV app within Apple TV. It's confusing for a lot of people, right? Until we actually use it. And I'm sure the first year, the first season, there'll be a lot of free games available to remove those obstacles, to make it as easy as possible to get used to that ecosystem, where to find the games, how does it work, what does the coverage look like. However, once after that is done and everybody knows where to find the games, there's going to be a lot of people that are not going to be subscribing to a service that only has one soccer league. Now, it'd be different if Apple had won the TV deal for the Champions League or had won the TV deal for La Liga or the Premier League, and you could actually watch other soccer leagues in addition to MLS. But the only way to go ahead and subscribe to the MLS TV deal, the MLS TV app within Apple, is specifically for those MLS games. It's not like you're getting a whole bunch of other soccer. So I think in terms of the accessibility still of the Premier League and just the growth that it's undergoing, and like you said too, in terms of being a de facto Super League, that will continue to grow. And I think MLS, for no fault of its own, it makes sense to move to the Apple ecosystem for a long-term deal to go streaming. However, this is not the Premier League. This is not the Champions League. MLS has a lot of issues in terms of getting average soccer fans interested in that league to watch it. And now having to pay, who knows how much it'll be. We'll find out soon, whatever that price tag is, in addition to all the streaming services that soccer fan already has. Let's move on to Christian Pulisic discussion. This comes from Mercator. He says, really good discussion on Pulisic, and I'm glad I'm not insane thinking that Tuchel has nothing against him either. I think many fans don't want to admit it, but I'm just not sure he is of starting caliber at a regular top four club. It's nothing against him. The very best players in the world play for top clubs at his position, but I do think he would be infinitely better off at a place such as Newcastle or elsewhere. Kartik, I know in terms of Christian Pulisic, we haven't heard much this past week. Maybe we'll hear something this week now with the transfer window. But what's your sense? Is he going to stay at Chelsea or be loaned out someplace?
I don't know. I mean, Chelsea have too many players. The question is, if they get Gordon in, he's not going to play at all. If they don't get Gordon in, he might still make these cameos like he did at the end of the Leicester match. So are those cameos worth it for him to stay there? I think that's more of an open question than people might think. I mean, I think certainly if he's getting 10 minutes, 15 minutes a match at a high-level club who are fighting to win things, that might be better than him playing 90 at Everton. I don't know. It's hard to say, it's hard to know and how it affects his mentality and his psychology in terms of his growth. I think his growth has leveled off.
Yeah, I think it's plateaued. I think it's plateaued.
And
that's the thing about Pulisic, though. I think that in terms of confidence, I mean, to me, that can't be a positive thing coming on as a sub, usually with 10 minutes to go, roughly in these games, and getting 10 minutes to prove yourself. And it's so difficult in such a short amount of time. And then you see, in that match this past weekend, Raheem Sterling really occupying his position, scoring twice, winning the game for Chelsea. And then Sterling comes off to a standing ovation. On comes Pulisic, does okay, but nothing special, nothing out of the ordinary.
At the same time, you got a guy like Ross Barkley, who they spent a ton of money on, another guy Chelsea has overspent on, who doesn't even have a squad number. So Pulisic is not in as bad shape as some other guys. This is, I think, a piece of analysis missed by Americans Who Whine. There are some guys at Chelsea who seem to be in much more in the doghouse than Pulisic is.
Yeah, and Ross Barkley getting paid $250,000 a week to not have a squad number and be sitting in the crowd watching these games, not really involved at all. All right, let's move on. NBC Sports, Greg has a comment for us. He says, you were indeed kinder to NBC in this last episode, and looks like a lot of us agree with your take on Peter Drury versus Arlo White, with Drury certainly being an upgrade. But if you miss the forest through the trees, when you compare the halftime shows on Peacock, why was the Man United against Liverpool halftime show better than the previous weekend? Because they don't have as many commercial breaks to run relative to studio talk time. So they're not rushing their takes. If you're going to compare that context, context is important. Halftime on the broadcast, NBC or USA and then NBCSN before, is always rushed due to all the commercials they have to run. And that's a great point, Greg. Definitely it's rushed. Sometimes it's amazing, not in a good way, but how many commercials they do fit in. It's like so Rebecca speaks for basically about maybe 30 seconds and off to a commercial, off we go. However, they do have an opportunity, even on those USA halftime broadcasts, to give some critical analysis. And I think it was that Brentford-Man United game where the halftime analysis, I think in some ways, though, too, is also that Tim Howard, being a former Manchester United goalkeeper, is kind of soft on his criticism of Man United, specifically on players. It's more kind of in the clouds, a little bit more vague. It's not pointed. It's not critical. And I think it was Robbie Musto that day too, where it's still kind of just kind of talking about it being a circus at Manchester United. It's kind of just your big criticisms, but nothing deep down analytical. And even with the time limits that they have, they can still go there. They can still drill it down to something specific where you walk away and go, oh my gosh, yes, definitely. That was one of the key issues in that first half with Brentford. I mean, winning 5-0 at halftime, that was an issue and that needs to be corrected. And I didn't get that. I did get it, though, in the Man United-Liverpool match. I thought they were much better halftime, and yes, they had more time. So I think yeah, timing is everything, but sometimes it's what you do with the time that you have available to you. And I think they're getting better, and it's early season still. Last but not least, Kartik, this is a good one, and this is something we don't cover that much. But Jim says, keep up the great work. He's starting off great here. All right, Jim, keep up the great work. I've been a loyal listener since the EPL talk days, since the pod and website focus on all soccer media. I wonder why you have had no commentary on SiriusX XM's FC channel, other than occasional live match commentary via TalkSport when the gaffer is traveling. Kartik seems to drink up anything ESPN FC does as Bible. And I find the football show in mornings on SiriusX XM FC and the unique week in the tackle and Friday grumpy pundits with Tom Rennie and Brian Dunseth to be thrilling and insightful coverage. It can't be the paywall since it costs just a bit more than a TV streaming service, but the personalities are so colorful and exciting that I prefer them more than the tight corporate coverage of Steve Nichol on ESPN or the two Robbies on of NBC. Ray Hudson alone is worth the price of admission, but I feel like the Rennie-Dunseth combo is a perfect combo, similar to the extremely popular and long-running Mike and Mike ESPN general radio sports shows that pitted an average player but good broadcaster with the witty career broadcaster. It's dynamite to hear them. I'd love some love for their show, but specifically the channel and the on-demand app for shows, which post daily content that you can always have on your phone. Let's face it, nobody cares what the ESPN FC crew looks like, and having audio means you can listen without caring about a TV. ESPN FC's analysis is a bit predictable, although they do spend time on each topic, probably why Kartik likes them so much. Oh, that's a great comment, Jim. So for me personally, I don't go in the car that much. I mean, I have a car, I drive around, but I have a home office. So oftentimes I'm at home, I'm not on the road. I'm watching matches throughout the day. I mean, sometimes it can start as early as, I don't know, noon Eastern time, and I'm watching matches from noon Eastern all the way through till, 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock, sometimes later Eastern time. And in the morning I'm working. So I'm working on the site. I'm writing articles. I'm making phone calls, doing interviews. So for me personally, SiriusXM FC, yes, I've heard good things about it, but for me, there's nothing that's really that I must listen to that's going to pull me in and say, hey, that's the show. Now, if I was traveling or if I was driving to work each day, or on the road a lot, I'm sure I'd be listening to SiriusXM FC a lot more. I know with TalkSport, I have a love-hate relationship with TalkSport. Some of the content they do is great. Some of it's really awful. Some of the analysts that they have on weekends, especially, Gabby Agbonlahor is horrible. Jamie O'Hara is just awful. I mean, I can go down the list. There's some really, really bad pundits that they have. Jason Cundy, I'm not a fan of. Sorry, Jason. But anyway, there are some good ones. But for the most part, I prefer, if I am listening to something, I prefer to listen to TalkSport. And it's not because of the money, but it's just because of the ease of access. I can switch TalkSport on in a minute. But SiriusXM FC, I mean, if I did listen to it, I don't think I'd listen to it that much, even if I had paid for it or had a free subscription. You mean, so that's for me. Again, a lot of it is depending on how it fits into a person's lifestyle. What about you, Kartik? How come you don't listen to SiriusXM FC? How come are you so obsessed with ESPN FC?
I don't have Sirius. I do drive a fair amount, but I listen to podcasts. So maybe that's why I like. I'm so used to Barry Glendening being in my ear for. Jeez. How long have I been listening to Football Weekly from The Guardian? What year? It's 2022. Yeah, so since I've been listening to Glendening and his snarky commentary for 16 years, and I'm hooked on it. And Max Rushton is a better host than AC Jimbo for me. So, yeah, I think it's because I'm listening to podcasts, and now I listen to the podcast that The Athletic puts out, which you don't, some of them you don't have to subscribe to The Athletic for. So I think that's the reason, actually. The Athletic has a pretty informative podcast, which is about an hour long after every Premier League match day. And then Football Weekly is now football like three times weekly. So that takes up the time.
Yeah. And for me, like Brian Dunseth, I have a lot of time for. I think he's when I have heard him in terms of his analysis on TV, really. I haven't heard him much on radio, but on TV, he's really good. I've been on the Grumpy Pundits a couple of times. And I know, Kartik, you've been on some of the shows. Yeah, I know you've been on some of the shows before too. So no hate for the SiriusXM FC guys or the channel, but it just doesn't fit into what we're listening to now. Now, Jim and others, it may be quite different.
Yeah, and also I should mention, when you mentioned TalkSport and BBC Five Live, they podcast everything. So that's another layer, right? So you can download those podcasts in whatever podcast catcher you have, which is something I do. So between Football Weekly, between Athletic, TalkSport, etc., I probably should listen to SiriusXM more, and it gives you maybe some more American perspectives. But unfortunately, there's so much content.
Yeah, that's the thing. At the end of the day, there's so much content to choose from. I mean, in terms of podcasts alone, but beyond that, television, I mean, on demand things, and also radio, of course. All right, listeners, if you do have any questions for us or any feedback, we'd also love to get any of your audio voicemails. The voicemails, you can call us at 561-247-4625. And don't worry, none of us will pick up. You'll get a voicemail prompt, so just leave your message there. Less than 3 minutes, otherwise it'll get cut off. You can also email us, and the email address is web@worldsoccertalk.com. Facebook is facebook.com/worldsoccertalk. Twitter is twitter.com/worldsoccertalk. And of course, worldsoccertalk.com, the website. When you get there, just click on podcasts and then just leave your comments in the latest episode. All right, Kartik, I think we're going to try to this week, we're trying to work out an interview. Last week we had Jordan Gardner, the co-owner of Helsinger Football Club from Denmark, as well as a minority investor in a club called Swansea City. You may know that team. And this week, too, we're working on getting another interview. And before we go, Kartik, where can people find you on Twitter? I know you've been busy. Politics, I mean, nature, Florida history, soccer, there's a lot to take in, but where can people find you?
Yeah, and hopefully I'll get back to actual soccer soon. You mentioned soccer. It's been mostly transfers, right? You know, and even the politics, the nature, the stuff I like to do is secondary to transfers. So I just wish this window would shut. Yeah, so you can find me at KKFLA737. And I've actually been breaking some transfer news, which I typically don't do. But this is a strange window, and there's a lot going on.
And what should the listeners do, and what are you going to do?
Enjoy your football.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.